What's up, my freaks, sharpness geeks, and purveyors of stabbing goodness? Welcome to the Knife Freak Show. My name is Jonathan Magnese, joined by my co-host, Mr. Chase Boatwright.
Greetings, sir. How are you on this fine day?
I am good. It's a little rainy and stormy outside right now, but that's all right. It's we needed it, and hopefully it's going to cool things off a little bit.
I think you're like a...
What about you?
I don't know. I think you've got superpowers or something. You said it's rainy outside, and about the time you said that, it started raining here. So you got some sort of voodoo magic.
Well, there you go.
Otherwise, I am good. Yep. I've been doing home chores. I've put in a light fixture in the bathroom. So, yeah, doing great.
Nice.
What about you? All right,
cool. Yeah, pretty much the same. A few chores around the house, some stuff outside. Got some stuff cleaned up at our pond that's down behind the house. Had to clear out the road down there, and I did that last weekend, I guess, and this weekend I did some weed eating or brush whacking down there, I guess, with the man. Those things, have you ever seen those saw blades that are made for weed eaters that are like, yeah, they make different kinds, but the ones that have like chainsaw teeth on them,
yeah,
those things are awesome. Like, those things are freaking great.
They look awesome, yeah, but they also look a little bit terrifying. But yeah.
Yeah, you got to mind your P's and Q's, but could definitely do some damage. But you can, when one of those is, and you can sharpen them like a regular, like if you got a chainsaw file, you can sharpen them like a chainsaw chain. And it, yeah, but a good freshly sharpened blade or whatever, and you can take out probably a 3-inch, 2.5 to 3-inch pine tree in like one swipe.
Jeez.
They're pretty awesome.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. I sort of did something similar yesterday too. I got like my father-in-law has like a walk behind bush hog thing, and I plowed through all sorts of brush and stuff around the house. But anyway, this is not the homestead improvement show or whatever. I am not Tim the Tool Man Taylor, but
that's all good though. The guys, they need to know. I mean, that's all these kind of things. You know, one of the things I've always kind of prided myself in is that, you know, I actually do activities, I actually live a life, you know. I mean, sometimes it feels like all I do is shop stuff, you know, like stuff related to building the knives, but I actually do stuff too, where I'm actually out, you know, using knives in the real world and stuff like that. Cause inevitably, anytime you're out doing something like that, you end up needing a knife for something. So, cause I did throw in a little fishing 100%. After the weed eating or whatever. So once I got some of the brush around the edge of the pond cleared back, I did a little fishing while I was there. So, course, needed a knife for that. So
nice.
So yeah, like doing the outdoor stuff. But anyway, how's the week in the shop been?
Pretty good. Been working on mostly fixed blades again this week. Got four almost ready. I don't know if I think I mentioned it last time, but I'm doing that little show at Mark's Outdoors here. It's in Birmingham, Alabama, for those of you that are close, but it's July 18th and 19th, I think. And yeah, so working on some stuff for that, and mostly just enjoying not working on folders at the moment, although I have still been working on folders a little bit, so I can't help myself. I see it over there needing to be done, and I'm, you know, it's not that bad to sit at the mill for a minute when it's, you know, 98 degrees in the shop or whatever, and I'm pouring sweat and grinding a blade or, you know, shaping my Carta handles in a dusty, sweaty environment like that. It's not always the funnest thing. So, you know, you go over to the mill and, you know, mill some stuff down, or, you know, mill lock relief, whatever, you know, that's not that bad. Little chance to sit in front of
kind
of
give you
a little
breather in between there.
Yeah. It's a working break is kind of how I look at it. It's like, I'm still working, but you know, this needs to be done, but you know, I can sit here and do it. It's not that difficult.
Yeah.
Y'all had a good week?
We had a pretty good week. So, we're working on, I guess that was just this week that we did the first skeletonized Mac 2 3.5. Yep. That was kind of almost
I meant to ask you about that.
It was kind of a spur of the moment thing, honestly. Like, I've thought about doing it for a while, and like, people have asked us about it. I just never really never really got the itch to actually do it, but we were, so where we're at with our stuff. So we got in as we were transitioning to the Dixons, we got in our last batch of, very delayed last of our batch of Mach 2 3.5 blades that were off to be ground. That whole very delayed thing is one of the reasons that we're now grinding blades in house. So point of that is now we've got a decent handful of Mach 2 blades that we got back, and I really want to transition to doing those grinds in house as soon as possible. So we're going to try to kind of, my intention was to switch over completely to the Dixons for a while, and we probably still kind of are, but I was really wanting to use up all the Mach 2 parts that we already had, blades at least, so that when we started back on them, it would be a clean break and we'd be doing the new grinds on them. I'm not sure that that's going to actually work out. I think we're going to have to do switch the Dixons for a while, and then when we switch back to the Mach 2s, we'll probably have to use that time to finish up the blades that we've got first and then transition to the new grinds. So, but anyway, so, but we are still, we had, we've been, we're trying to get on schedule with the Dixons, which means, so we're trying to get the timing down so that we have the material, getting the water jet, you know, before he runs out so that he stays stocked, and then the water jet supplying us with parts before we run out, and then keeping them, all the steps that we do in the shop, getting them ground, getting them on the mill, you know, getting them processed, getting them finished and turning them into, you know, actual builds, trying to get all of that lined up so that we're in a steady flow of doing X number per day and keeping X number per week coming to us from the water jet and, you know, X number of material coming from the material suppliers to the water jet monthly or whatever. So really trying to kind of get a system in place where everything just flows and stays on schedule. And it's taken us, you can't just, you know, because one step depends on another. So you can't just do it all at once. You know what I mean? Like you can't just say, okay, from this point forward, you know, cause you have to wait on the water jet and then we get the other stuff done. And then we have, I skipped the whole heat treat step in there, getting like on blades, getting them in here, doing the milling and stuff on them, sending them off to heat treat, getting in a cycle of getting them back every couple of weeks. So we're sending blades out to heat treat every week so that within probably by this coming week, we should be on a schedule of getting blades back from heat treat every 2 weeks. Well, every week. It takes about 2 weeks to do them, but we've, you know, we've sent enough batches now that we should start getting in a batch every week. So anyway.
Oh, that's good.
We're
That whole rigmarole of like keeping the flow going is a very difficult thing to do.
It's a one process huge balancing act.
Yeah, one process goes slower than you expect it to or faster than you expect it to, and then there's a hitch in the giddy up, there's a kink in the chain, and the whole thing starts, you know, it you know, snowballs from there. So it's a very difficult balance to kind of get all that straightened out.
It is.
I'm sure it will never be perfect. I'm sure you could ask the, you know, biggest companies in the world and they still have issues like that, I'm sure. But like, it's all about trying to make it better. So.
Right. Yeah. We're trying to streamline it as much as possible and kind of automate it as much as possible. But the, that's been honestly one of our biggest challenges over the last year or honestly, since we've been doing this.
Yeah, I was about to say, since I've been there, that's, you know, since way back when I started, that was always sort of a thing, is trying to figure out, you know, when to order, how much to order, you know.
Yep. But it's not like we have unlimited resources either, where we can just order, you know, tons and tons and tons at a time. You know, we're getting where we order bigger and bigger amounts of stuff, but it's still, you know, you could think, well, just buy a whole bunch at one time and then make sure you don't run out. Well, yeah, but you got to have the cash flow to do that. So that it's
I mean, you spend a whole bunch on hardware and you spend a whole bunch on hardware and then you're not able to, you know, get enough titanium cut or, you know, send enough blades to heat treat for all that hardware or whatever, cause that money's tied up and the whole thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You've got to balance it all out. It's kind of like doing your household budget. Like you've got to figure out how much of each thing you can afford to get at one time and then and balance all that out and try to keep things flowing. And honestly, that whole process is one of the reasons that we've kept moving more and more stuff in-house, because we run into bottlenecks. And so we basically then just decide, okay, we got to, you know, we just got to bring this process in-house so that we can eliminate the bottleneck, or at least for the most part. And it's worked pretty well. We're down to, you know, only having the couple of things that are not in-house now. So, and hopefully we can keep that way, but we'll see. But anyway, the whole point of all that, though, is that we've had a little bit of a lag on getting into rhythm on schedule with the Dixons. So we've been building some Dixons, some Mac2s, and that's where the skeletonized one came in. We needed to build, and the guys were like, what do you want us to, you know, on the mill? He's like, what do you want me to run? And I was like, you know what? Here, let me do this real quick. And so I went in and whipped up the program for it, and it took us, we did a couple of single ones, took us a couple of tries to get it the way we wanted it, and then we were off and running with it. So it actually went surprisingly well, but it wasn't that bad, since we basically took the weight reduction pockets that were already in there and just essentially made them go all the way through, and then added, you know, put a chamfer on both sides. So it's not like I had to come up with a complete whole pattern or whatever. It was already there. I just had to pretty much change the programming. Didn't really have to model anything up different. Just change the programming to have it cut the pocket completely out and then chamfer it. So
nice.
So anyway,
that was a cool thing to see. That is one good thing, I guess, to finish this segment off. Like, you know, when you do have those lull periods, you can kind of, you know, sometimes that does inspire a little bit of, you know, creation or, you know, something like that, something a little different to come out of it. So I guess that's, you know, positive aspect of trying to find the rhythm.
Sometimes you find absolutely. You can definitely push some of your creativity.
Yeah. All right. Yep.
So I believe we had a little bit of news, didn't we?
Yeah. I found an article, or I believe I was sent an email from Blade Magazine about this article called Knife Steel After Crucible Industries, and sort of going back to covering that whole thing that we covered a lot at the beginning of this podcast, like where, you know, Crucible is now owned by Aerosteel, which is I saw something that it on here. I thought it was a French company, but apparently it's owned by another person or another company that's like in Sweden, I think. But anyway.
Yeah, I believe that's right.
Crucible is no longer a United States company. They were bought out by Aerosteel, and basically the whole article was talking about how Niagara is going to be sort of filling in as much as they can for the Crucible loss, especially in terms of like the names, all of the trademarks, like CPM MagnaCut, CPM S35VN, like those are trademarked names. There are other, you know, maybe not necessarily those steels, but like 20CV and M390 are basically the exact same thing, but M390 is a trademark held by Bowler. 20CV is a trademark that was held by Crucible, but now Aerosteel. But, you know, those are like proper, I guess that's like Corvette and Mustang sort of essentially.
Yeah.
So basically the article is talking about how Niagara will be able to use a lot of those names for the CPM steels, given the conditions of buying from Aerosteel and, you know, going through their particular process. But the good thing is that a lot of those names will not be changing, except there is a couple of exceptions. In CPM crew wear will now be known as NSM wear. So Niagara Specialty Metals wear. And then S90V will be NSM 90 PM. So those two are technically changing. I could see some makers out there still calling it S90V or crew wear. You know, depends on, you know, I mean, and they're not necessarily lying, or I don't know, being, I don't think that would be intentionally misleading, but those are the new names offered from Niagara. Crewwear will be offered by another distributor, is what the article says, exclusively under the name Crewwear. So that'll still be out there. But anyway, so yeah, really good article about all the, and it also goes into the steel tariffs. It goes into, you know, all the different things about what Niagara's doing up there, talking about their new steel called Magnamax, also developed by Laren Thomas. So I'm guessing sort of in the MagnaCut series. I don't know much about that steel particularly, but I hadn't really read up on it. But yeah, just a really good article that I thought I would share and, you know, kind of go through and I guess update everybody that has been around since the beginning when we were talking about all that.
Yeah. It's very interesting, and it's going to get a little weird and with some of the naming stuff or whatever. And, you know, you got to think that this stuff, you know, there's still supplies of this stuff floating around. I mean, we've still got a supply of the original MagnaCut, you know, that hasn't been started being made over there yet or whatever. So, you know, you're not going to see necessarily an immediate shift to different names and stuff because people still have some supplies of the old stuff out there. But yeah, it's going to get a little weird just seeing the name changes and also, like for us, you know, trying to keep everything as made in the U.S. as possible, it's already challenging. It's about to get a lot more challenging. So yeah. I'm honestly not sure. I'm really looking forward to the Magnamax and seeing what all the details are on it and how much of the process, because I'm not sure if it's going to be a powdered steel or not. If it is, then my understanding is they can't do.
Yeah, I believe it had a CPM prefix.
It did. Okay.
Yeah, somewhere in the article, I think. Right. Can't find it at the moment, but yeah.
Yeah. If so, then my understanding is that the only place that has that there's basically nowhere anymore in the U.S., I guess, since Crucible, you know, went out of business, there's nowhere else here that has the set up to do the actual powder, the atomizing of the steel to do that process. So at the very least, some of the process will be done somewhere else, it sounds like, for that steel. And so it's going to get interesting, but I will say this for us, it's, you know, I would much prefer to buy a steel that's ideally 100%, you know, made everything in the U.S. Problem is, I'm not sure that that's going to be anything that you can find, at least not in the higher grade steels like people are expecting to see in folders. So, but yeah. I also think there's a huge difference in buying, you know, buying steel from a company, especially because some of the stuff I know there's steels that, you know, some of the work is done and then Niagara gets it and like rolls it and processes it and stuff in their plant up there. So like, you know, there's a big difference to me in buying steel from that part of the process or even all the process was done in somewhere like Germany or Sweden or something like that versus just straight up outsourcing your stuff to China. Like that's just two different ball games. You can try to, you know, go down that rabbit hole and, you know, try to justify that because not everything is 100% absolutely, you know, every little bit of iron ore and everything else that was mined, that everything came 100% from the U.S., you know, that if it's not that, then, well, you might as well just have your stuff outsourced to China. Like, I think that's a huge leap. I think there's a lot of nuance in between there.
That's a very big stretch. I mean, you know, if I was a woodworker and I got a piece of wood from, you know, the jungles, the Amazon in Brazil, and it was just a piece of wood when it arrived to me, and I turned it into a, you know, beautiful table or something, I don't think anybody can make the argument that that table was made in Brazil.
Exactly. You know? That's a great analogy. Yeah, exactly.
Like just to dumb it all down. Like, I mean, we're not talking about, like, you know, we try to buy as much as we can, like you said, as far as the raw materials and stuff in the U.S. as well, but we're making a product in the United States.
Yeah. But taking it from a raw sheet of titanium, especially, like I said, some of the stuff, I don't guess all of it, but I know some of the stuff is being, you know, processed, rolled out and processed and stuff like that by Niagara once the initial stuff is done anyway. So like I mean, there's no, unfortunately, like I said, I wish we could have just a solid, you know, solid breaking point of like, okay, here's a steel over here that's 100%. Everything about it is made in the U.S. You know, I would love to be able to have that. You know, that's absolutely what I would want to use. But unfortunately, it looks like that's not much of an option right now. Maybe with some of the push to bring manufacturing back, and I've seen, you know, while the cutlery industry is a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of what the steel industry worries about, I've seen stuff about the steel industry in general, you know, kind of, even though we're talking about Crucible doing the exact opposite, but that was in the works for, I think, quite a while, months and months, that's been kind of on the horizon that they were going to end up going out of business. So it's not because of any kind of recent developments, but I have seen other steel companies and stuff talking about reinvesting and back into manufacturing more back in the U.S. and stuff. So maybe we'll end up with some better options before it's all said and done.
Hopefully so. I mean, that's all we can really, you know, as us as just the consumer end, you know, for this particular industry. Like, I mean, that's all we can really do is hope for the best, yep. Really.
We're kind of at their mercy a little bit. So, and it's like everything else, guys. Like, I always want to try to do as much as possible. I want there to be better options, like because, like, for example, if I go to buy a computer, what's the chances I'm going to go find a computer that's made in the U.S.? Like, especially one that's 100% made in the U.S. I'm not a computer expert, but I'd be willing to bet the chances is totally zero that I could find a computer that's 100% made in the U.S. You know, same thing with almost all electronics and a whole lot of other stuff. And what I don't want to see happen is for that to be the case with the knife industry, because that's, you know, that didn't just happen overnight with these other industries either. It started slowly being chipped away at until everybody was just getting their stuff made somewhere else and you can't get it made here anymore. You know what I mean? Like, that's one of the reasons that I buy so hard for the American made stuff and the knife industry in particular is because I don't want to see that happen to the knife industry. And when you look back over those of you that have been around long enough, like, you look back 10, 12 years and the knife industry looks completely different than it did 10 or 12 years ago. So if it's changed that much in essentially a decade, like, it worries me to think about what another decade or a couple more decades is going to look like as far as, you know, it staying alive and the American knife cutlery industry leading the way. You know, I don't know. It's just, it's scary for me to think about that we could go the way of electronics and everything else, and then all the major manufacturing in our industry would be outsourced. So,
yeah, I mean, that's, you know, like you said, it's not a overnight thing, but I mean, it's a slow process of, like, okay, some people start to do it and it becomes acceptable into the market and it becomes, you know, gains momentum and, you know, more people start doing it. And all of a sudden it's, you know, instead of doing it the hard way, why would we do that? Let's do the easy way and make more money. And, you know,
and that's exactly what's happened over the last 10 to 12 years, you know, in our industry. I mean, if you look at it, it went from being basically totally unacceptable. Like, the, you know, nobody was going to be, you know, you basically get laughed out of the, you know, show or whatever, if you showed up with a bunch of stuff that you had made in China. And now it's, not only is it commonplace, but it's, you know, it's arguably, you know, I wouldn't say it's the majority, but it's definitely gotten a very strong foothold. So.
Oh yeah. Yeah, for sure.
And what was that?
Scary time. Like, it's a scary time, and it's like a weird time, especially for, like, you know, a lot of the younger makers, a lot of people that are younger than me and my age and stuff, like, we've kind of, I guess, sort of, you know, grown up in that. And there's some like me that haven't gone that route. And there's others that, you know, sort of jumped on board right away. And, you know, I'm friends with them either way. Like, they're, you know, the ones I'm friends with are still good people. But, like, it's, you know, it's sort of a weird thing to kind of try to navigate that whole social circle aspect. Cause they'll, you know, I've had people ask me, like, hey, why don't you, you know, do this? Like, I know a guy, like, I can put you in contact with him. And I'm like, nah, that's not for me.
Yep.
Just straight up. So, but, beyond that, did you have anything else to add to the, article.
Yeah, while I'm thinking about it, I want to add one more thing in on that while we're down that rabbit hole. Let's go ahead and poke the rabbit bear. So another thing, so I had somebody that was in the OEM space as far as like doing OEM work, like they're an American shop doing OEM work, whatever. And they were talking to me about people were wanting to get stuff done, and it was people, I guess, that had already gotten stuff done like in China, and they came to them wanting to build it. And basically they weren't willing to do it unless they could make like a 300% margin on it. And this guy, of course, was like, I literally, there's no way I can build it that cheap. Like the price they were needing him to build it for, so they could make a 300% margin was like, I mean, he would have gone in the hole just buying the materials. You know what I mean? Like there's absolutely no way, you know, not just a matter of him making a little less profit. Like he was literally would have gone in the hole probably just buying the materials. And so
yeah,
that if a 300, which, and from what I understand, that's, you know, I've heard that number thrown out a couple of other times too. So if you're looking at people that are having stuff made in China, and I don't know that every single one that this is the case, but if that's kind of like the standard is 300% margin, then do you know how insulting it is to see in some of these talks about knockoffs and stuff? I've literally seen people talking about how the companies are getting knocked off. If they weren't so greedy and charging so much for their knives, that maybe people wouldn't be buying knockoffs or whatever. I am at nowhere near a 300% margin on my knives, guys. Like nowhere near it, I can promise you. So you might want to rethink who you're calling greedy when you look at this whole scenario, because those of us that are doing it the way we're doing it, I can guarantee you that anybody that's making their stuff in the U.S., they are not, I mean, unless they're riding some kind of really good, you know, hype train and they've got their prices kind of, you know, elevated because their stuff's super popular right now or whatever, maybe they might be close to that number. But I can guarantee you that most of the people that are like me and around the price point that we're at, we're not making anywhere near a 300% margin. So to call us greedy while the other people that are having stuff made there to, you know, and making a 300% margin off of it, that just blows my mind. Like it just, the seeing how skewed people's outlook is on this stuff. Like it's people just do not understand.
Like if people knew how much like these guys that are getting OEM folders are paying for the folders, I mean,
right.
And then turning around and selling them for $400, $500, you know, even $300. Like,
yeah. Well, yeah, a lot of the prices have crept up now to where they're within like $100 of, you know, people like us. Yeah. So yeah. Like, but yet theirs has probably a 300% margin on it. And ours has got, you know, not even a, you know, fraction of that. So
yeah,
but we're the greedy ones and we deserve to get our intellectual property ripped off because we're so greedy, because we're charging so much for our knives. Like it's just, that's highly frustrating to hear that.
Yeah, for sure.
So that just something to keep in mind, guys. And I don't know exactly how much these people are paying for their knives. Like I said, that's not the first time I've heard that 300% margin thrown out. So just keep that stuff in mind when you're looking at where you spend your money. And, you know, especially before you run around calling somebody greedy. Not that I think anybody that's listening to this probably would do that, but just when you see other people doing it, just keep that in mind. It's the people that are doing it the hard way. I guarantee you it's not a greed factor. If it was a greed factor, we'd all be doing it much easier way with much higher profit margins. Like I could be, Lord, I could have made so much more money by now if I was doing it that way. And I know, you know, to some people, from a business aspect, that sounds stupid that I haven't done it. But, like, it's just, yeah, it makes it highly frustrating when people accuse us of being the greedy ones.
Yeah. I mean, as with everything, there's trade-offs. And, you know, like in building a knife, there's trade-offs in how you run business and where you maximize profits and where you minimize profits in a very real way, you know. Purposefully minimalizing profits is definitely a thing for a, wouldn't say secondary goal, but a, you know, a different minded goal than just maximizing profits. Yeah. But anyway,
Yeah. Don't get me wrong. I'm not against making a profit. Just,
oh yeah.
But to do it ethically and, you know.
Yeah. Like, that was sort of what I was trying to say, I guess.
Right.
Sorry, guys, if y'all hear a bunch of rumbling and rambling. My dog is under my table that I'm recording on, and she's terrified because it's storming outside. So
mine's doing that. Mine's the exact same thing. I'm kind of awkward sitting here because I can't put my feet under my desk because he's down there hovered up under me. But also apologize if we have some little delays or weirdness on this episode, guys. Yeah. If we have some delays or if I'm like talking over Chase a little more than normal, I'm having a really hard time hearing him today because the ambient noise, because I'm in a metal building and it's raining and my hearing's not great anyway. So I've got the speaker over here. I'm like leaning in as close to it as I can to try to hear him. So I apologize if it's a little awkward today, but we're trying to get it done in spite of the weather. So anyway. All right, so indeed. I think we had one question we wanted to hit, maybe?
Yes, we had a question that was not necessarily attributed to anybody. It was more just one that I had kind of floating around, and you know, I've heard it asked on a lot of other podcasts and stuff, was, do you have any advice for a new maker? And do you want to lead off on that?
Lots. Yeah, but this may end up actually being almost a whole episode.
Yeah.
What's that?
That was actually sort of where I had this listed in my notes, was in the like episode ideas. But for now, I figured it would be a sort of good primer for what we've got coming next.
Yeah. 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 Because it was something we kind of wanted to mention today, and this kind of leads into it. But yeah, we may end up going back maybe even next week and doing maybe a full episode on this. We'll see, because there's a lot of different things we could talk about on that. So do you want to start off?
Yeah, sure. And I guess one of the biggest things I would say as far as like new maker advice, assuming you're already kind of up and running and making stuff, you're already a maker, not necessarily like trying to figure out how to get in. My biggest thing would be to listen to what people don't say. Like if people are like, oh, I really like your handles. Oh, I really like your blade shapes or whatever, but if no one ever mentions the grinds, if no one ever mentions the finish, if no one ever mentions, you know, a bunch of these other things, I would say try to listen to what people don't say, is one of the biggest things.
Read between the lines.
Yeah, for sure. I believe I heard that from Todd.
That kind of goes back to what we said last week about people, you know, if you don't know, have something nice to say, don't say anything at all. That may be a case where people are practicing that, and the nice things they're saying to you, you know, yeah, don't get too hung up on the praise that you're missing the fact that that they're not technically criticizing you, but maybe they're leaving you some clues as to places that you need some work. So that's a good point.
Definitely. Yeah, you have to be your worst critic, and it's I know I definitely am. I don't know if I've been happy with a knife I've made yet. Like, I'll be happy with it for about 5 minutes, and then I'll see everything wrong with it. So,
yeah. Yep. So on that note too, I think,
of wisdom?
Like I said, we're not going to try to get into every part of it since it was kind of something specific I wanted to talk about, but I will say on the note of what you just said, also having some thick skin, and learning where to have thick skin, but not so thick that you like ignore anything negative that people say. Like, you can't write off everything negative that people says is that person is just being a jerk. Okay. Sometimes that may be the case. There are going to be people that are literally going to say stuff just to try to piss you off or just to try to, you know, get attention or whatever. You know, their mama didn't bring them their Hot Pocket quick enough that earlier that day in the basement. And so they've got to lash out at somebody, you know, something like that. But we may have to do a Hot Pocket shirt. It seems to be a recurring theme on here. So, So, you know, people, they may not always say it in the most tactful way, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's not true. All right. So even now, like still people will, you know, when people criticize stuff, I try to look at it, you know, first I go through like some phases, you know, first I'm just pissed off and like, you know, anyway, we'll leave it at that. I'm pissed off. And then, I have to stop and think, okay, well, is there some validity to it? Like, is that actual something that needs to be improved on or whatever? And sometimes it's yes. And there's been many things that I've improved because of people's criticism or whatever. But so have thick skin and know that you're going to get criticism, but also don't just dismiss it just because it is criticism, because a lot of criticism is actually beneficial. It's not all just people being jerks. So you've got to be prepared for that. And just, do not let your ego get in the way, because it will want to. That's where those phases of it, come in. Like, initially my ego gets bruised and I'm like, in knee jerk reactions and get pissed off. Then I have to calm down a little bit, stop and think about it, get my ego out of the way a little bit and decide, is this a legitimate complaint? Or, and a lot of times too, it's just an opinion. You know what I mean? Like, it's like a, yes, I could do this different and that person may like it, but I don't like it that way. And maybe the majority of people don't like it that way. Or, Like, it's not, sometimes it's not that neither one of you are wrong. Maybe the way you're doing it's not technically wrong, and the person's criticism is not technically wrong. It's just that their criticism is how they would like it better, and it's not necessarily right or wrong. You see what I mean? So it's like, and you have to decide what you like better, but also what the majority of people like better, because when it comes down to it, you're probably not planning on keeping all your knives yourself. So, you need to be in tune with what the customers want as well. So, just because somebody has a criticism and that could be considered correct doesn't necessarily mean, there's some things that are kind of cut and dried. Knife doesn't need to be dull. It doesn't need to have hot spots. There's certain lock doesn't need to fail. There's also a whole lot of nuance. It's just a matter of opinion.
You don't necessarily, you need to have a little backbone behind some of your, expertise or your design cues or your ethos that you're bringing.
A reason why you're doing it a certain way.
A little bit of backbone with that. And then also,
you don't want to be too wishy-washy and
incorporate it into your own style.
Right. You'll never be able to settle on a way to do stuff if you wishy-wash back everything that people say, because you'll get opinions this way, you'll change that, and then somebody will complain about it and want the exact opposite. And then, you'll never be able to settle on something if you're too wishy-washy. So you need to figure out, again, you need to weigh it in, and is it a legitimate point? And if it is, do I need to, is it something I want to change, or is it, do I like it better this way and the majority of my customers like it better this way? I can see where they're coming from, but, I just prefer it this way and other people prefer it this way, whatever. So don't let your ego get in the way, but also don't, have reasons and, like you said, kind of a backbone as to why you're doing things a certain way too. So, but not so grounded in it that you're not willing to listen to other opinions. So
definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
so I believe with that about, becoming a new maker and getting into an industry or getting into a certain thing, you kind of had some thoughts and some ideas about, paying your dues.
Yep. Yep. For sure. Paying your dues. So I feel like this is not just beware, like old guy rant coming on here, because it's certainly not true of everybody. And like you're a lot younger than me, and so you're a good example of proof that not everybody is this way. But I feel like a lot of younger people, and it's not exactly their fault, it's our fault, the older people that are my age or so and older, that let culture turn into people getting 17th place trophies and everybody's a winner no matter what. And like, you deserve to be equal to everybody else, no matter what, no matter what you do, whether you put in the work that they put in or not, you should still get considered equal as them. Like that has harmed our culture greatly. And I see it in our industry, and not just our industry, but just in general, like people, and That, and again, told you this old guy rant, the internet is another big part of it, and the culture that has developed around the internet to include, you know, online shopping, Amazon, you know, next day, 2 day delivery, stuff like that. People do not understand delayed gratification anymore. People think that they're entitled to have what they want right now, as soon as they want it. And if not, then they're going to throw a hissy fit, or they're going to take a shortcut, or whatever. Like, and like, guys, that's just not the way it works. I mean, it's just not in the long term of things being. Very rarely do you do something impulsive and it turn out to be the best thing. Most of the best things in life come with some delayed gratification. You know, like, for example, it would be very gratifying for me to go eat a big old piece of chocolate cake and wash it down with some milk and maybe a couple of cookies to go with it. And God dang, I'm getting hungry. I got to stop talking about that. But I would prefer to be healthy and to look decent. And so that is a delayed gratification. I could have the gratification right now of eating the big pile of desserts. And in the moment, it would be nice. But in the long run, I would pay for it with my health and the way I look. And so having delayed gratification, and there's no shortcut around that. You can't have both. I mean, you can, you know, you could maybe eat a little bite of the cake and whatever, and one nibble of a cookie and get a little bit of instant gratification and then still get your delayed gratification. So there's a little bit of, you know, balance there, but for the most part, you can't have it both ways. You can't literally have your cake and eat it too. Like, you can't have your cake and your six pack too. Like, it just doesn't work that way. And it's that way with a lot of things. Like, you can't be a top paid expert in your field the second you walk out of college, unless you're just some kind of like mega genius or something. Like, and even if you are, you still probably lack the experience to be a top paid person in your field. You know what I mean? Like, even if you're the smartest person that's ever come through that college program, you still don't have the experience to max out your salary the minute you walk out of the college, you know? So like, there's a lot to be said.
If you did, sorry, I was going to say, like, you know, there's nowhere to go with that either. Like, if you start at the top, there's nowhere to go. Like, it's, you know,
right. But it's just not, it's just not the way it works. Like, it's natural law. Like, it's not, you know, you have to put in some time to get there. I mean, most people are not super wise when they're in their, you know, teens and twenties. Like, you have to have some life experience typically to get wise. You know, some people are lucky and they have somebody that's a good mentor that can help them, you know, shave some time off of that if they're smart enough to listen to them. But you still have to get the experience. And so when it comes into the knife world, you know, I think that we, for sure, there's so many people, and it goes back to kind of what I was saying earlier too about the outsourcing stuff. It's not just that. It just so happens that the outsourcing stuff has made it easier. Just like the internet and Amazon has made it super easy. We're all spoiled now, myself included. We're all spoiled to be able to get stuff and get it quick, right? You know, we get something and it's supposed to be 2 day shipping and it takes 3 days and we're pissed off because it's been so long, you know, that, you know, or it's taking us forever to get this thing. It's been 3 days. I mean, come on, you know, like we look at it completely different. So, it's definitely changed the way we look at things. And so people being able to outsource, you know, having knives made has definitely pushed that along in the knife industry, because now people, basically all they have to do is draw something up. It doesn't even really matter if it's good or not. Like, you draw something up, it doesn't even matter if it actually functions or not. You don't even have to have paid your dues enough to know the actual mechanics of how to make the knife work properly as far as all the design features. And you can still have a knife made and put it out there and promote yourself as a knife company. So now, are you in business and are you, you know, technically a knife company? Yeah, I guess, you know, I guess you are, but do you have the same kind of knowledge and the same kind of everything? And probably, are you going to have the same kind of longevity as somebody that has paid their dues and knows all the ins and outs and isn't totally dependent on somebody else to do all the heavy lifting on it? And that kind of stuff. You know what I mean? You're kind of setting yourself up for a flash in the pan kind of thing if you don't pay your dues typically. And I feel like that's true of almost anything, our industry and everything else in life. You know, if you don't pay your dues, you're more likely to be like a flash in the pan. Yeah, right. There also have a tendency, I think that most people, that's a good point that you made about having skin in the game, because I feel like people that have a skin in the game are more likely to care more about the industry and want to do things that are beneficial to the industry as a whole versus just get theirs. You know what I mean? Like that's, I'm not saying that there's not people out there that care and try to do the right thing by the industry, you know, that are, you know, maybe haven't paid their dues based on the criteria that we're kind of talking about here. And two, like, when I say pay your dues, that doesn't mean you've got to make knives for 20 years before you, you know, come out and show a knife in public. Like, you know what I mean? Like, there's nothing wrong with, you know, getting started and getting after it. And honestly, the other thing that I think that people are really selling themselves short on when they don't, when I say pay your dues, I'm talking about, you know, designing a knife, learning how to make the knife. Not that you have to actually physically be able to make a knife to design a good knife, or to have a knife company. Like, you don't necessarily have to do that. But I do think it gives you a big advantage if you do know how to actually make them. And one of the things that you get an advantage is like, I know for me, and my design language has changed drastically over the years in a lot of ways. And it's mostly due to trial and error. It's because I paid my dues, because I've put stuff out there, I've gotten customer feedback on it. You know, I've put in enough time to also be able to look back at some of my earlier work and see things that now, you know, I look at with a different set of eyes because of the experience that I've had in the meantime. You know, it just, you're kind of robbing yourself of a lot of learning there if you just jump straight into it and like somebody else is making, you know, you're literally just doing a line drawing on paper, or maybe you have enough skills to do a, you know, a 3D model of it or whatever, but you've never actually, you know, put metal to the grinder or whatever. Like, I just feel like you're leaving yourself
steel to the wheel.
You're losing a lot of knowledge that you could gain. You know, I mean, yes, you can put out iterations of a knife. So you could design a knife, have it made, put it out there, get feedback on it, revise it, do it again. But you're talking about, I mean, all of these people that are doing that, OEMs, it's all in batches, right? You're not doing like one or two knives and putting them out there and getting feedback on it and changing them. You're putting out, you know, probably a minimum of 250, 500 knives at a time. You know, I don't know what their minimums are, honestly, but I would guess probably at least 200, 250 for most of these small run stuff that's OEM. Yeah. And so you're not being able to like get the feedback on putting out, you know, I built this one of this model folder, I put it out there, the person got it, and before I get the next one built, I'm already getting feedback on that one. So then the next one, we've talked about multiple times how stuff evolves, you know, sometimes on the fly as you're making something. Like, you've got your pattern, you're changing it, you know, you find something you don't like about it, on the next one you're literally changing it kind of just on the fly. So you're getting a lot faster feedback loop and being able to make changes and make adjustments a lot quicker instead of having to wait until you can raise the money to, you know, on your next pre-sale to get your next batch of knives done or whatever. And then you get them in. I don't feel like people are as prone to get feedback, make changes and adjust as they are if you're kind of like making them one at a time, you know what I mean? Versus having a batch made at a time. You get a lot quicker feedback loop and you're learning a lot with that. I mean, think about it. Learning is, a lot of learning is feedback. You get in that feedback loop and you're trying to, you know, you're learning from your mistakes. You're learning from the feedback we talked about, from the criticism we talked about earlier. You're learning from that. You know, you're being able to make adjustments a lot sooner rather than having to wait until you do your whole next big batch of knives, you know, that gets shipped in to you. And then get them in and be like, oh, well, I wish I'd have done this different or whatever. Now you've got to wait till the whole next batch before you make another change. I see that as a disadvantage for people that are doing that they're not getting the feedback and they're not being able to grow as a designer, you know, and since if they're just designing and not making, then wouldn't call them a maker. But
yeah,
you know,
I mean,
you see what I'm saying? Like,
yeah, even every time I send a design to Waterjet, I get the blanks in and I am immediately unhappy with them. 100% of the time I have sent stuff to get Waterjet, I get the parts back and there is something I am not happy with out of the box. I'm all excited. Right. I've got parts now. I've got things that are going to make my life easier. And I open the box and I'm pissed at myself immediately because there's something I overlooked. There's something I missed. There's something I didn't do right. And so it's like, in one way, that makes me sort of constantly sort of trip over myself. But in another way, I mean, like I don't ever, you know, that change, that thing that's wrong never sticks around for any length of time.
It's how you learn. Like, it's how you learn and how you develop by making mistakes. If you've got somebody, if there's something going on with your design and whoever's making it for you is making the changes, you know, or whatever, and they may be making the changes just to make the thing work right and you don't even really know what they did, then like, how are you ever growing as a designer or whatever? Like, and then what happens if you decide that you do want to make the stuff yourself one day, or you, which is one of the reasons that I think it's so hard for people to, once they start down that road, to ever transition back to doing it a different way. You know what I mean? Like, you're so used to having somebody else do it for you. You're not necessarily, you know, learning from the mistakes that you would getting that almost instant feedback from, you know, making a knife, putting it out there. Like, I feel like that's a big disadvantage for people in the long run of being able to, you know, grow as a designer and, you know, maybe become something more than just somebody that draws up designs and sends them out to have them made. And what happens if that pipeline gets shut down? We've seen all the geopolitical stuff going on right now. What if all of a sudden, you know, or tariffs make it, you know, to where it doesn't make sense that you basically can't afford to have them done there, or they shut it down completely and you can't have it done there. Well, do you still have a company? Like, because can you transition and do something different? Can you do it yourself? You know? So like, you're putting yourself, in my opinion, in a disadvantage by not paying your dues and actually learning the ins and outs of what you're doing. You know what I mean? Like, it's just, and the same can be true of any industry. Like, I just, you know, I don't want somebody that doesn't know the mechanics and stuff and doesn't understand all the mechanics of a car, like designing my car. You know what I mean? Like, I want,
if you can't change,
I want somebody that,
or, huh? Yeah. Like, if you can't change the oil on your car, or like that Tundra you had, they put the damn starter behind the exhaust manifold. Like, no, don't do that. Right. Like, do you not understand that this makes this job infinitely harder due to your placement of this part? Like, it does not go together. You do not understand how this works. And
yeah, I think some of that's a classic disconnect between some of the engineers and the
I think it's part that, and I think it's part making it difficult for the consumer to work on it intentionally. But that's, I digress.
Yeah, and auto industry, that may be some of it with that industry. But yeah, you get what I'm saying. Same thing with building a house, whatever. Like, I don't want, you know, well, and for example, I don't, you know, and it's a little bit different. I guess it just kind of depends on how you look at it and what business model you want to have, because like, an architect is not the one building a house. And if you ask anybody that builds houses, most of the time they have to change stuff that the architect has on the blueprints. Like, it doesn't usually work exactly the way the architect has it laid out, because in real life, everything doesn't go the same way it goes on paper. And there's things that they overlook because they're not the ones out there doing the stuff. So it's kind of the same thing, you know. I feel like it's a disservice to the person, the maker, the whoever that's doing the thing, and it's a disservice to like your customers and stuff if you're not willing to pay your dues and you're just so ready to be, you know, the next cool knife maker or whatever, that you just jump right in and like, you know, hey, I've got a knife design, and hey, so-and-so's making it, and here you go. Like, just, you know, I don't know. I just, again, maybe some of this is just old guy stuff, but I feel like there's lot to be said about paying your dues.
Yeah, there's definitely some of that instant gratification of, you know, oh, look, hey, I've got a booth at Blade, and I'm the cool guy, and a bunch of people want to come and talk to me, and, you know, like, all that.
Yeah.
I think that definitely goes on, especially for people that are, you know, in the industry as consumers, and then try to make that transition into having a company and, you know, have stuff built overseas or have stuff OEM'd and whatever. Like, there's definitely, I think, an aspect of social currency in that, as far as, you know, both on social media and in person and stuff.
It almost becomes like a popularity contest. Like, everybody wants to be the, you know, like you said, the cool guy. But the problem is, they want to have the cool guy side of it, all the glamour that you see of being behind the booth at Blade Show, without going through all the headache of what it takes to get to that point. You know, it's just, and like I said, you could say this about a lot of different things besides just our industry. I think that our society as a whole is doing itself a disservice by, you know, people not being willing to pay their dues. Now, I get it that we live in a lot faster world than we used to. A lot more information is readily available. You know, there's a lot of opportunity that was not there before, right? So you can learn stuff at a lot faster rate. So when I say pay your dues, I'm not necessarily saying that you've got to, you know, make knives by hand for 20 years before you decide to do a production folder. And I'll be honest with you guys, looking back, like, I was too much to the paying your dues side of this than I should have been, because I looking back, I wish I had started doing the production route several years sooner than I did, which would put us probably several years ahead of where we're at right now. But I didn't have the confidence, for one thing, and I felt like I had to pay my dues, and I had to have a decent amount of time in the industry and, you know, have my name built up and everything before I just dove into doing, you know, production level stuff. Like, you know, I wanted to,
I think that's
kind
also
of build up organically. Go ahead.
Sorry. What are you saying? I think that's sort of a product of the time you sort of came up in as well. Like, where you were coming up in USN and, you know, all the other guys that were doing the bigger stuff, and like, so.
Well, yeah, and because the other stuff, the other wasn't really an option.
I think we're lagging a bit.
As far as doing the OEM stuff, like, yeah, I mean, you didn't have guys that you've never heard of that happened to be, you know, in some Facebook group or just popular on Instagram or whatever, that all of a sudden, you know, or a reviewer or whatever, and then all of a sudden they've got a knife brand. Like, that didn't happen. Like, not to my knowledge anyway. But I also felt like I needed to, you know, build my way up and to build it like organically, so that I had enough of a following for my work that kind of warranted going into a production level versus jumping right into a production level and then trying to get the audience to, like, hey, here's my production stuff. You see what I'm saying? Like, let it grow to the point where, like, you can't make enough stuff to service all the customers that want your stuff. So then you go to the next level and you go to production stuff and you start doing production stuff to try to meet the demand, versus just jumping straight into production stuff. And, you know, here's hundreds or thousands of knives, and, you know, then trying to find the customers or whatever. Like, so, but to be fair, I did lean probably too much to the other side of it. I probably should have made the leap at least 5 years sooner than I did. I just, you know, I didn't. I felt like I needed to pay my dues and didn't really have the confidence, I guess, to do it, because it was a whole new learning curve that I'm still learning. But so the one point I do want to make, though, too, is that don't make the mistake of thinking that we're talking about, like, gatekeeping, all right? Because this is a whole different thing. I can promise you there is very little, if any, gatekeeping in the knife community. Because if you're trying to learn how to do stuff, people, like, nearly everybody out there will openly and freely give you information and show you how to do stuff and tell you how to do stuff. Like, it's still, I've been doing this for 17 years, and it still blows me away when I go, even like the Blaze Show this past, I mean, Pat, this year, you know, people that have been in the industry way longer than me that have got kind of, you know, proprietary type things that they, systems that they've figured out, and I'm, and they're freely giving me information on them. You know what I mean? It's like, and it's been that way the whole time. And I try to do the same thing. You know, I try to be free with giving out information. So I think the knife industry is probably the last place that anybody could accuse of there being gatekeeping as far as information on how to do stuff and get started and do things. Like, there is plentiful information out there. Like, I mean, it, and it's been that way the whole time I've been in it. Like, people would gladly tell you, you know, but a lot of people, especially the people like me, what they don't like is people that want to be spoon fed. All right. What I don't appreciate is when somebody wants to come and ask a question or be shown how to do something, and they've put zero effort into figuring out how to do it themselves to start with. They've done no research on it. They've done no, you know what I mean? Like, don't, like, I wouldn't feel right going to somebody that's, you know, going to a Rick Kinderer or somebody that's, you know, years ahead of me and being like, you know, hey, how did you do so-and-so, knowing that I haven't even, you know, like, I'm just totally trying to piggyback off what he's done without having to, trying to figure it out myself ahead of time, or at least gain some level of knowledge on it. You know what I mean? Like, to just totally, there's a difference between asking for help and just wanting to be spoon fed everything. And in my experience, the people that want to be spoon fed, they're not going to do crap anyway. If they don't have the enough interest in it and enough gumption to actually be trying to figure it out and actually do stuff, then whether you give them the information or not, they're really not going to do anything with it, which is why it aggravates me, because I know if I give them the information, it's a waste of my time, you know. But if somebody's got a problem, they're stuck, they're whatever, you know, they have some information on it, but they just can't quite put everything together, more than happy. And I feel like, I mean, you're a good example of that. I mean, that's, we're sitting here because,
yeah, definitely.
You know, you asked and here we are, you know? So it's,
yeah,
I just,
like, I mean,
I can already didn't see walk into your shop and say,
hey, teach me everything you know.
Right. You went about it the right way, and you already had a lot of knowledge. You'd already been trying to do some stuff yourself. You just hadn't quite connected some of the dots. And honestly, some of it too was just, in your case, was just needed a little push. Like, to you're one of those that falls more on the planning side, you know, and wanting to, you almost know everything before you do, versus know enough to get started and figure the rest out as you go. So you need a little bit of knowledge and a push, you know, but a lot of people just, you know, like I said, all they want to do is just basically, they want you to spoon feed them the information. You know, they're not going to do anything with it anyway, because if they haven't put any effort into it to that point, then they're not going to do anything. And so that's a little frustrating. But whole point of all that is, because I can already hear the argument to my thing about paying your dues being that, you know, oh, people shouldn't be gatekeeping. Well, if you've had any experience in the knife industry at all, unless you're just coming at people like a total jerk or something, then I can guarantee you that nobody is gatekeeping, you know, other than maybe a very few examples here and there. Like, it's unbelievable the amount of information that's shared in the knife industry. I guarantee you people in almost any other industry wouldn't believe it if you told them how open our industry is with sharing knowledge.
I had that experience with that earlier this week, talking to a listener of the podcast, actually. He's a drummer, and he interacts a lot with custom drum builders. And, you know, he was talking about, like, that community, it seemingly, from what he said, can be very toxic and sort of shark infested waters sort of thing, where you know, people don't necessarily get along like that. And I'm like, that's, I don't know how I deal with that. Like, you know,
polar opposite.
Like, I mean, most of the people I talk to on a daily basis are other makers, and, you know, I ask them questions, they ask me questions, we just talk about stuff. I mean, it, like, you know, it's free and open. And there's only been one or two occasions where I've asked somebody something, and it was, you know, a very specific pointed thing about, like, a very unique part of their process. And they were like, well, don't really want to give that up, but you're on the right track, is basically what,
right.
You know?
Yeah.
And it wasn't
like, there are occasionally little things. Yeah.
Yeah. It wasn't anything major. It was about a particular finish or a particular way to do a, you know, type of handle or something like that. And like, it was, but it was everything else I've ever asked those individuals have been, you know, well above board.
Right. And there may be occasion like somebody's got a specific finish that's kind of proprietary to them or whatever. Like, I mean, there's nothing wrong with, you know, kind of wanting to protect some of your intellectual property a little bit if it's like something specific to what you do and you don't necessarily want everybody else replicating what you do. I mean, that's, there's nothing wrong with that. But as far as like how to make a knife in general, you know, like, you could be literally flooded with information, you know, like you could go, you know, you could probably go on Instagram right now and have, you know, answers back within 24 hours from multiple people that are, you know, with years of experience just by going and asking. I mean, it's just, there's, I don't think anybody could ever accuse in general the knife community of there being a problem with gatekeeping, because I if there is, I've never seen it in 17 years. Like you said, other than maybe a couple of random individuals that just happens to be the way they are, or like I said, very specific processes that you probably shouldn't be asking them about anyway. If it's if it's kind of their thing and you're wanting to replicate it, then you know, maybe, you know.
And that was probably ignorance on my part, not realizing that, like, you know, that's unique to them. I probably shouldn't ask that. And that was back in, you know, sort of earlier days. So, you know, younger, naiver type of days. But,
but they handled it gracefully, sounds like, you know.
Yeah, for sure. And, like, you know, talked to them a few weeks ago at Blade Show, and, you know, perfectly cordial, happy, you know, all good.
Yeah. But, probably happy to see you doing well.
Yeah. I'm happy to see them doing well as well. So, I mean, it's all, it's all love and butterflies and rainbows here.
Yeah. Well, and also think about, tell me this, like, what other industry have you seen where you see that many people? Like, it's totally common, maybe not at the show as much, but it is totally common to like watch people's videos and stuff and see like other makers wearing like other makers' shirts or gear, or, you know, merch and stuff. Like it's totally like everybody is like super supportive of, you know, of their buddies and stuff like that. Like it's not, it's a fantastic industry when it comes to, you know, sharing and having good attitudes toward each other and all that. So.
Yeah. I have seen a little bit of that sort of essence, I guess, creeping into like, maker communities in general, where like a bunch of different makers will share a common space and like, you know, these modern things that they do and like sharing and helping information and doing stuff like that, and maker communities sort of getting better in just like in ceramics and in, you know, other stuff like that. So I think
makers in general,
sort of making a comeback, or sort of, you know, like getting out there into other places a little bit, but I've never seen I think on the level of,
well, that makes me, when you said that makes me kind of think that, you know, I think there's probably something to that. The fact that, because makers know what goes into what you do, like, and they can appreciate what other people do. You're not just in business, like selling a product, like you're creating a product, which goes back to what I was saying about the people that are paying their dues and actually makers versus, you know, sellers. Like true makers actually making the product themselves. Like, I think that just lends itself to a different kind of mindset, a different kind of appreciation for what other people do, you know, versus, you know, somebody that's not doing as much of the creative process and the actual making process. I think it just probably breeds a whole different kind of mindset with makers in general, I think.
Yeah.
I can appreciate, like, I see stuff, you know, like I love watching people do like ceramics, like pottery and stuff. I love watching glass blowing and stuff like that. Like, I think makers in general tend to appreciate other makers of all different genres, you know, probably more than the average person does, just because they're just kind of wired that way, but also because they know what goes into reaching that level and, you know, kind of honing their craft and stuff. So anyway,
because they've paid their dues and they understand what goes into
that. Exactly. And it's like a mutual, it's kind of like, you know, like how really some of the strongest bonds that can be made are made through adversity. When people go through adversity together, it tends to give them a really strong bond. And so maybe they didn't technically go through it together, but makers know the adversity that other makers have gone through to reach the point that they're at. And so I think that kind of gives them a somewhat of a bond, even though they may not have literally been doing it side by side. They have an understanding of the adversity that they've gone through. So that actually, I think we've, I think we've rambled about this enough that we've kind of gotten down to some of the core of why, you know, why I feel like paying your dues is important.
Yeah. You talk to them and you're like, oh, you've burned your, you know, fingerprints off of your thumb a million times too. You've, you know, cut your hands a million times. You've, you know, you've had the sore hands and the sore forearms from, you know, doing all the stuff, and, you know, you've breathed the grit and the dust and had it all over you in the hot summer sweat, and, you know, you've gone through the fire, and now we're out on the other side.
Well, sometimes,
and,
literally.
Well, we're still in it, but, you know. There's sometimes there's fire, but it gives
shop
you that
backs level catching on fire, slinging them out in the yard so they don't catch the whole shop on fire.
That was a fun day.
To kind of put a bow on this real quick, because we're starting to run a little long. I think I knew I was going to ramble about this subject a good bit. Partly because, let me just say, I don't want to make it seem like that there's some big barrier to entry that like people can't get started or can't do this. Anybody can do this. The information's out there. It's like it's totally doable. You can get into it. It's not that expensive to get into it, especially not if you do it like I did. Like I've told the story before, so we won't go back into it. But like anybody can do it, and I'm absolutely not discouraging anybody from doing it. What I'm encouraging you to do is to pay your dues so that you truly learn and you truly understand and you truly get that maker spirit that we were just talking about. Like it's, you will set yourself up with a much stronger foundation to do what you want to do with this if you actually pay your dues. I'm not saying you've got to work in the dark for 20 years before you, you know, try to do something else. Like, but you know, a reasonable amount of paying your dues, I think, is not too much to ask for somebody to build something worthwhile. So the last part of that I'd like to mention is there's a little bit of that. So from the collector's, you know, end of it, I feel like there's a little bit of a, you know, dues to be paid as well. Like it takes some time to be in this industry and like, you know, learn all the information, learn what to look for. And most of you have done that, you know, and most of us have started off with, you know, $50 knives, $100 knives, $200 knives and worked our way up, kind of paid our dues, building our collection, spending more money each time. You know, learning the different things, you know, buying stuff maybe that you end up not happy with and, you know, learning your lesson from that, like, and also building relationships, because like it or not, like there's times when having a good relationship with a maker or whatever ends up paying off and you get a chance at something that maybe, you know, somebody else didn't get a chance at or whatever, you know, like it or not in any industry and anything in the world, that's the way it goes. So, you know, there's a certain amount to be said for, you know, putting in the time, paying your dues as a collector, learning, making friends, making connections, developing relationships and stuff that can not only maybe help you build your collection, but also make your collection mean a whole lot more. Because you think about something that you, a knife that you got from somebody that you built a relationship with for the last 2, 3, 5, 10, 15 years, you know, that's going to mean a lot more to you than just a knife, the cool looking knife from some random dude that you don't even know. You know what I mean? So I feel like there's, we could probably talk a good bit more about that, but I think there's certain amount of dues to be paid as a collector and stuff as well. You know, thinking that you're going to jump into the collecting game and you're starting to, you know, immediately going to have all the coolest high end stuff, you know, and get every drop and all that is just probably not reasonable. So there's just a certain amount of, and that's what makes it worthwhile. If you could come, if you could just jump in immediately and buy everything you wanted right when you want it, well, how long would you even want to do it? You know, not long. Most people wouldn't. You'd burn out really quick. So,
yeah, I mean, it definitely would, it would feel a little empty to me. I think the, like we've mentioned 100 times on here, it's the people, it's the relationships, it's those sort of things. Like, you know, one of the collectors that's been with me since the beginning, you know, he sent me a slip joint that I still own and love. Like, it's a random German made slip joint, but like, he knew I liked it and we had talked about it and he sent me one. And like, you know, just those little things make me admire that knife that much more, I think.
Yep. That's right. Well, we probably talked this out a pretty good bit. We may hit it some more on the future episode, but I think we've got some meat left on the bone to talk about all these topics a little bit more, but probably need to wrap it up here for today. So we greatly appreciate you guys. Please make sure that you subscribe, give us a like, please comment. We really appreciate the feedback. Hit us up with some questions. Chase is going to give you the email address before he signs us off here. So please keep supporting us. We appreciate you guys very much and hope you have a great week.
Yep. And that email address is knifefreakshow@gmail.com with one S, knifefreakshow@gmail.com. Catch us on Instagram. Subscribe on YouTube, Spotify, Apple, wherever you find these things. And like he said, comment. And we're running a little low on questions, so feel free. Please send us your questions. I'm probably going to post a question box later this week on Instagram. But with that, let your freak flag fly.